MRAP Breaking News.
As the COVID pandemic continues on, we've learned more and more about cardiac issues associated with the infection. A number of articles have been published on this, and we've got a whole section dedicated to it in COVID Core Pendium chapter, but we really haven't discussed it much on the audio. So we've got Amol back to get us a little bit up to speed on the topic. Amol, welcome to MRAP once again to talk COVID.
Thanks, Swami. This is a really interesting topic. It's been a scary topic, but I've been following this, what I refer to as cardio-COVID, the cardiac manifestations of COVID ever since the very beginning. And it's a really, really interesting disease. And thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk about it. I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, and we're going to be discussing a lot of that literature that's come out, of course, realizing that we're going to learn more and more about this in the years to come, because we just have a very tight window of time that we've just begun to learn about this. So we're going to have some uncertainty in places. That's okay. Let's start with some of the labs that we get on these patients. If a sick COVID patient comes in, we get a slew of labs, including a troponin. In many places, that's what happens. And many of them have elevated troponin levels. The question is, are these type 1 MIs, the myocardial infarction from coronary occlusion? Are they type 2 MIs from supply-demand mismatch? Or is it something else completely different?
Sure. Well, actually, COVID puts you at risk for both. So if you get a troponin on these patients, in all likelihood, it's more likely going to be the type 2, the supply-demand mismatch that you refer to, maybe from hypoxia or just the stress of having sepsis or a dangerous infection. And in fact, the studies have indicated that when you look at patients with COVID that are hospitalized, because those are mostly the patients that are being tested, maybe up to 40% of patients will end up having a bump in troponin, and that's usually how myocardial injury is defined. And only about 30% of those patients have underlying cardiac disease. So this is not something that's only seen in patients with underlying cardiac disease. These can be normal patients also. But the studies also seem to indicate that patients are at increased risk for the true type 1 STEMI or type 1 infarction as well, the ruptured plaque followed by platelet aggregation and thrombus formation. And there's a couple of reasons why that may develop. COVID produces this tremendous inflammatory response, sometimes referred to as a cytokine storm. And the inflammation in and of itself induces endothelial dysfunction and causes plaques to become unstable. So if you already have some plaque formation, it can turn stable plaques into vulnerable or unstable plaques. Now, the reassuring thing is that if you don't have any plaques, it's not going to my knowledge, at least, and based on the literature, it's not going to create new plaques within, of course, of a couple weeks. But if you already have plaques, it can make them unstable. And so either type 1 or type 2 can end up developing. In the literature, more often type 2.
So we have to be worried about getting an EKG on those patients and scouring that EKG, looking for ischemic changes. We have to, of course, get the history from the patient. If they have a significant cardiac history, they're going to be more at risk of this. We don't want to overactivate our cardiology team for every positive troponin. I mean, I literally would have been calling them for every patient I saw for a good 6 weeks. So we have to be a little bit more nuanced in that approach, but I think it's the good management we've already done. Look at the EKG, look at the troponin, look at the patient, put all of that together, and then decide which of those patients you're worried about having a type 1 MI.
Exactly.
Now, if we have that type 1 MI, so if I have the EKG changes, I have that high-risk patient, I have a good story, is there anything different in terms of the management for those patients if they have COVID and a type 1 MI?
Well, the quick answer to that is no. You should do everything that you were doing before the pandemic, now during the pandemic, in a patient who has proven COVID or suspected COVID. The one exception, I guess, is that you need to make sure that everybody who's taking care of that patient is properly PPE'd, including the people upstairs. And because it takes a little bit of time to get the team upstairs all set and properly protected, the registries that have been traditionally looking at how long it takes to do the cath, CMS, and all the rest of those regulatory bodies, they have provided some leniency there. And so there's not as much of a rush to getting these patients up to the cath lab. There still is a rush, but you can take a little bit of extra reasonable time to get the patients properly PPE'd. The answer quickly is no. There's a little bit of an interesting backstory, though, in that when the pandemic first began and these STEMIs started showing up in emergency departments in China and Italy, you know, a lot of the cardiologists were, frankly, afraid to take these patients to the cath lab. And so they were telling emergency physicians, you know, if you think it's a STEMI, just give them thrombolytics. We don't want to take these patients up to the cath lab. And so they even put out some guidelines recommending that these ST elevation patients with COVID, they should be getting thrombolytics. The problem with that, though, of course, is that when they have ST elevation, we don't know whether it's myocarditis or STEMI. And if you're giving thrombolytics to a patient with the myocarditis or myopericarditis, you might be inducing some pericardial bleeds. And on top of that, we know that a third of the time, thrombolytics don't work even with the true STEMI. And so those patients are going to end up needing to go to the cath lab anyway. So it never made sense for them to be saying, give thrombolytics to everybody. So international guidelines and definitely national guidelines have now come out just to make it very clear again of what we said just a few minutes ago, that if you see ST segment elevation in a COVID or presumed COVID positive patient, you should be doing exactly what you were doing before, get them to a cath lab.
And I understand where the cardiologist was coming from. We had the same kind of obstacles and issues early on. There was so much unknown around this. But now, like you said, we've got some good recommendations, good guidelines on what we should be doing here. So if you've got that type 1 MI, if you work in a cath center or if you're transferring to your cath center, you should not expect anything to be different in terms of the management. You're still going to be asked to give your antiplatelet agents, your aspirin, your clopidogrel. You might be asked to load with heparin. You're going to be asked to do a lot of these things if you have a STEMI on your hands, and then you're going to get them to a cath lab if possible. If you can't get them within a window, then you might be still giving thrombolytics, but nothing should be really all that different than what it was before, except like you said, the extra levels of protection that not only us, but our consultants need to be taking on those patients.
Exactly.
All right. And when we were deep into the surges, Amal, we saw a lot of tachydysrhythmias. So let's shift off of MI to that. And one of the ones that we saw quite often was atrial fibrillation. And I think that my assumption, and probably the assumption of a lot of people, is that those atrial dysrhythmias were very similar to what we would see in sick ICU patients with sepsis. This is a common dysrhythmia that you see when you have these really sick patients. We discussed the management of unstable atrial fibrillation with Weingart back in January 2020. Is there anything that we have to think about differently with COVID with these atrial dysrhythmias?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. The arrhythmias really is kind of the hot topic in cardio-COVID now. And in terms of management, you probably don't need to do anything differently with one exception, and that is to just be wary of a potential prolonged QT in these patients. And we'll get into that in just a little bit more. But rapid AFib is just one of the arrhythmias. These patients are at increased risk for all types of supraventricular arrhythmias, SVT, A-flutter, AFib. I even, on one shift, unbelievably, I saw back-to-back MAT patients. Now, how often do you see MAT? Hardly ever, right?
No, but we look for it a lot. Don't find it a lot.
It was incredible. You know, I've seen MAT, I don't know, maybe once a year. And on one shift, two back-to-back pulmonary COVID patients had MAT. It was incredible. I was sky high that day. But actually, I shouldn't have put it that way. But anyway,
we'll edit that out.
From an arrhythmia standpoint, I was really excited to talk about those patients with the residents. But they are at risk for ventricular arrhythmias as well, monomorphic VTAC, polymorphic VTAC. And it's a little bit more than just these patients are sick ICU septic patients. These patients are particularly prone to SVTs of various types and ventricular arrhythmias, because of, once again, that sympathetic or cytokine storm that puts patients at increased risk for supraventricular and ventricular arrhythmias. And then on top of that, if the patients develop myocarditis, well, we know myocarditis can also produce tachys and bradys as well. So beyond just the fact that you're dealing with a sick patient, specific to COVID, those patients are also at increased risk for arrhythmias from above and within the ventricle.
And maybe that's one of the take-home messages here, is that if you see those tachydysrhythmias, because they don't happen in every single patient, but if you see those, maybe you have to at least consider, if you weren't considering already, things like myocarditis and pericarditis. You might not be able to make that diagnosis in the emergency department, but something to think about as a possibility, maybe pass along to your consultants as well.
Exactly, yep.
You alluded to the QT interval, and in the CoreP chapter, we do focus on torsade very specifically. Is this something that we're seeing more frequently in COVID?
It does appear so. And the reason is that, as I mentioned, COVID increases the risk for QT prolongation from a few mechanisms. Number one, and this is something I never knew before reading about all this cardio-COVID stuff, but significant inflammation, systemic inflammation, and especially inflammation in the heart all by itself can prolong the QT. That's something that I never read before, but because COVID is kind of the hallmark, I guess, hallmark of inflammatory cardiac diseases, the COVID infection by itself can prolong the QT. Add on top of that, some other causes of prolonged QT. Diarrhea and dehydration are common amongst a lot of COVID patients, and that puts patients at risk for prolonged QT via hypo-K and hypo-MAG. In addition to that, COVID produces a K-leuresis, which is an increase in secretion of potassium in the urine, which increases the QT via hypo-K. And then add on top of all of that, patients are on various medications that also may prolong the QT, maybe antihistamines and over-the-counter medications. Maybe somebody started on azithromycin or hydroxychloroquine and some of the other medications. So there's a handful of different reasons why patients are at risk for prolonged QT, and you need to worry about torsade. And going back to your prior question with regards to treating AFib or, for that matter, any arrhythmia, I would caution people about using medications that might prolong the QT further. For example, amiodarone and procainamide. I'm not saying don't use them, but whenever possible, try to check the QT. And if it's long, I'd stay away from using those type of medications.
Really speaks to our need to meticulously check those electrolytes, look for causes of prolonged QT. And it seems really simple, I'm all to say that, but when these patients are sick, there are so many different priorities that sometimes you lose track of things like potassium and magnesium and repletion. So we just need to keep an eye on those things and remember that these patients are saved by good basic critical care and good basic resuscitation, and electrolytes are a big part of that. So scour that EKG, look at those electrolytes, replete as necessary. And I think this is something that, you know, as much as we talk about all of the different medications that we thought about for COVID, anticoagulation, proning, electrolytes were something that we were really having to check very closely and replete quite a bit when we were really in that surge of patients.
Totally agree.
All right, let's bridge from the tachydysrhythmias and the MIs to some of the other problems that we see. We've already discussed a little bit about pericarditis and myocarditis, recognizing that pretty much any virus or many viruses can cause pericarditis and myocarditis. We have heard lots of reports with COVID about these disorders. How common is it actually, and what do we do in terms of management?
It's a bit unclear because, of course, patients that are COVID infected and relatively healthy, or even symptomatic patients that end up being discharged, nobody's really testing them for things like pericarditis or myocarditis. I don't know that EKGs were routinely being performed on patients with mild infection. So most of the data that we have, primarily on myocarditis, has to do with hospitalized patients. And what we do know is that COVID can invade the myocardial tissue and cause direct myocyte infection and even myocyte death. And as a result, these patients are at increased risk for myocarditis. And how much at risk, it's a bit unclear, but autopsy studies have shown that myocarditis has been implicated as a contributing cause of death in up to a third of patients in one study. And then, of course, a lot of this depends on how you define myocarditis. Is it purely based on the EKG plus a positive troponin? These patients are not routinely getting biopsies, and they're not routinely getting autopsies either. There's an MRI study from Germany in which they looked at about 100 patients that had presumably recovered from COVID infection on average 71 days after their COVID infection. And on the MRIs, they looked for signs of ongoing inflammation. And amazingly, the MRI studies were showing some cardiac involvement in 80% of patients and ongoing signs of inflammation in about 60% of patients. Again, this is 71 days on average after the original COVID infection. These people are back to work, they're recovered. And so myocarditis is probably a lot more common than we realized, even in the patients that aren't terribly sick. We don't really know how much of a factor it is in patients that are recovered, but it does seem that it's relatively common. And the sicker you are, the more likely you have evidence of significant myocarditis. But even in the relatively healthy people, you can have some ongoing slight signs of myocardial inflammation going on.
A lot of the sickest patients that we saw with COVID, that I took care of with COVID, had right heart strain. Now, whether that was from pulmonary embolism or severe lung disease or ARDS that they were already developing, it could have been any of those things. Is this a real phenomena? Is right heart strain and pulmonary hypertension more common? Is right ventricular dysfunction more common in terms of COVID? And what do we know in terms of recovery from that pulmonary hypertension?
That's a really important point that you bring up, Swami. The right ventricle, once again, is the forgotten ventricle with COVID, but actually it's very important. There's a couple of echo studies that have been done which have found that right ventricular dysfunction is actually more common than left ventricular dysfunction in patients that have significant COVID-related infections. Now, who knows in the asymptomatic COVID and people that are outpatients, but in the admitted patients, it appears the right ventricle is probably more commonly infected. There's a few reasons for this. It may partly be related to macrovascular thrombi, in other words, PE, or microvascular thrombi. That's a very common finding. Tiny, tiny little clots that are probably too small to pick up on a CAT scan are contributing to pulmonary hypertension, ARDS, and increased afterload can cause problems. And all of these different things lead to pulmonary hypertension. And it appears that if it's bad enough and long-lasting enough for the right ventricular distension to lead to right ventricular remodeling, it actually predicts a twofold increased risk of mortality. In terms of recovery, probably these patients have a good prognosis if they haven't gone on to develop that right ventricular remodeling, but it's a little tough to know. What I would say is that if a patient is recovered, they're back to normal activities, they probably don't have or aren't going to have significant sequela. But the patients that do develop some right ventricular remodeling probably are going to go on to have at least some degree of problems with the right ventricular function down the road. Now, I'm emphasizing and bold printing the word probably because it's still so early that we just don't know. There's not a lot of good data to say since, as you pointed out, we're only about a year and a half into this disease, but we'll have to see what happens down the road. But that seems to be probably what we can expect to find.
And that's a good bridge, Amal, to long COVID, which we have been talking about a lot. But like you said, we're only 18 months in. We only have limited information about long COVID. This is going to really pan out over the next decade or 15, 20 years that we see this. But one of the things that we hear quite often is that patients have chronic shortness of breath. They have chronic decreased exercise tolerance, chronic fatigue. And how much of that could be due to pulmonary hypertension, right ventricular remodeling? Who knows? Because not all of these patients have been able to get echocardiograms or even had echoes before they had COVID. So it becomes very hard for us to tease all this out. Let's talk about what we do know or might know at this point in terms of long COVID and cardiac sequelae. How much has been reported on this?
Well, there's really not a ton. I've seen editorials and heard some cardiologists talk about the fact that because there may be ongoing myocardial inflammation, because heart failure and myocarditis seems to be a significant factor in the very symptomatic patients, there are some folks that are predicting that in the coming years that there might be an increase in the number of patients who are previously COVID infected who go on to develop some degree of heart failure, and then we'll throw in the right ventricular problems also. It's possible, and I've heard some people proposing that there might be an increase in the number of patients with some degree of pulmonary hypertension down the road who were previously infected with COVID. It's just so early that I don't know that we really have a good handle on how much of a problem that's going to be down the road.
And you're exactly right. We only have limited information. We'll see what more information comes out over the coming years. We'll, of course, update everybody. And then finally, Amal, I think one place that we just have to mention is about the COVID vaccine-related myocarditis, which we've heard lots about. It's all over the news, especially in younger age groups, especially in men between the ages of 12 and 29. And so let's just mention very quickly up front, we do have cases. It does seem that it is more common than we would normally see in background rates, but the rate is still extremely low. The most recent report from the CDC says that it's about 0.004%, about 0.004% of second doses of the vaccine have myocarditis associated with it. It's about 41 cases per million. And at the same time, that prevents about 11,000 cases, about 550 hospitalizations, about 138 ICU admissions, and 6 deaths. So a very low risk of myocarditis, not something that should be stopping people from getting vaccinated. Amal, I think this is a nice way to wrap up all of this COVID card stuff that's been cooking in your mind for the last year. and bring it together in one audio. And of course, like I said before, we'll update this as more information continues to come out and we continue to get more developing. I have a feeling that Cardiology Corner for the next couple of years is going to have frequent mentions about long COVID and more information that's coming out on that. So we'll be revisiting this with you down the line as more data, more information comes out.
That sounds great, Swami. Thanks so much for your time.